Welcome to this week's episode of The World According to Craig. And as usual, I have someone that I am absolutely excited about, mainly because anyone who's associated with anything art, architecture, design is incredibly fascinating to me because it's a skill that I do not have and therefore love immensely. And so I am so thrilled to have Charlie Harbison with me today. Fashion designer extraordinaire, creative mind and genius, all of this.
Oh, yes, all of that.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Of course, I'm super happy to be here. And I have a bad tendency of doing whatever it is you ask me to do.
Well, we'll see if we can keep that entertaining for the masses. So we're going to talk a little bit about the intersection of creativity and all the things that fascinate me, but to cheat the angle a little bit. But I always like to start by helping people get a sense of who you are, because for everything that you can Google on somebody, it's awesome to see their personality. And I'd love for people to know where all of this comes from, like as you as a background. Like, you grew up in North Carolina.
Yes.
Surrounded by all kinds of strong Black women.
I did, actually. Yeah, it's true. I mean, I grew up in the foothills of North Carolina.
Oh, so foothills, like rural country.
Period.
Oh, I lived in country, but it was Indiana. So yeah, it was not the same at all. I had cornfields. Yeah. You had Appalachian Mountains.
Exactly. Okay. And cotton fields and all that jazz.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
But yeah, it's an amazing place to have grown up. And I grew up with a very kind of working class, blue collar background. And so that was relegated to both the men and the women. And just, I think by way of that, I kind of saw this amazing way of living where during the day you were quite gritty and you know, just your work required a lot of power and strength and getting dirty. And then particularly with the women, but not only them, but particularly with them on the weekends, I would just see this amazing transformation. And I saw that in mom, but...
So gritty to like Sunday best?
Yeah, 100% that. But not just Sunday. It was also like trips to Charlotte.
Oh, okay.
Where the mall was. And it was me and mom and her girlfriends. And I was like the approved kid who could go because I keep quiet. And in many ways was just enamored with them in this whole process. And I loved like the mall and I loved like trying on outfits and all that stuff. And it was,
you were their dress up doll. You have
100%.
Okay.
And I had thoughts and feelings about what they would choose.
Oh.
And at times I would offer that up.
I'm trying to picture 9-year-old Charlie Harbison being like, oh, girl, don't wear that.
Try 6 and 7. Like I would just, it was kind of like, oh, I like the red. It's really pretty. And like, I still have like outfits in my head that mom wore that made me particularly happy. My brother and I were literally just texting about that like last week.
That's incredible. I don't remember anything from when I was 6. So like, God. I love that you remember the outfits that your mom wore, that you were a fashion critic. I was going to ask when the fashion bug hit, but apparently it hit at the mall.
Yeah, it 100% hit at the mall. It hit in her dressing room, hit, well, not her dressing room because there wasn't a dressing room, but like hit in her closet. And, you know, when she's like choosing what to wear on like Sunday or first Sunday, which was like the Sunday where the women wore white or things like that. And I would always have an opinion. But growing up in North Carolina was amazing, like surrounded by family. My extended family was in the same neighborhood that my
close-knit family was. I miss that about LA. I miss like LA doesn't have neighborhood family like hangouts. I mean, my parents do live 4 blocks from me, so I'm very lucky in that respect, but like that's not a thing.
No, it's not at all. And where I grew up, it was like you were in walking distance from cousins, you know, much less aunts, uncles, but then cousins, second cousins, first cousins. And then my great grandmother was kind of the center of the neighborhood. So then her children lived in the neighborhood, and then those children, my parents' generation.
Okay, so when did you start getting creative and taking scissors to things before you went whole hog on architecture?
As a young boy, like I just loved drawing. I can remember loving crayons and art, even in like nursery school and kindergarten. That was my favorite time. I also remember being hyper-focused on coloring within the lines. It was really important to me. And then I remember this girl, she would darken the black lines. with the color that she would then apply inside the lines, but to a lighter degree. So there was a darker border of the color red and then color inside. So then I was like, oh, clearly I have to do that.
This was a very involved coloring spectacle.
Oh, 100%.
I was not this involved.
Most things with me are very involved. And most things with you are incredibly involved, but maybe
not
just
coloring.
Exactly.
Not coloring.
Just not that.
Not crayons.
But it was amazing. And I loved it. And I think my folks saw that I was great at it. My teachers did. They were lovely at affirming me.
That's amazing. And so everyone was supportive of the fashion creativity of it all.
So not the fashion creativity.
No, just creativity.
Okay, jumping ahead.
just the coloring.
Yeah, but just the coloring. And then they put me in painting class and all that.
Okay. They were down for you to be an artist.
Yes. They were down for me to be artful and to be skilled at it and to use that as a means to get access to other things.
Okay.
So then when I was going to college, it was clearly I'm going to go to college only for architecture. I was great at math and science and I loved art. So I'll be an architect, got to school.
How do you be great at math, science, and art altogether? I'm not great at any of those things, Gemini. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
So maybe it's the duality there, but I enjoy rules and I also then enjoy breaking them. So maybe there's something there. I don't know.
Oh, that's going to get us into our topic too. You have a whole career of knowing the rules and mm-hmm. then breaking the rules thoughtfully and artfully with the type of design that you bring to bear as a fashion designer, right?
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. it's turning expectation a little bit on its head.
Yes, completely. Because there's craft there, which I appreciate. So those are the rules, right? It's there's an understanding and a craft to dressmaking, to tailoring, to understanding certain elements of dressing in our society. So there's skill there. And then in order to make it fashion and artful and, all that jazz, yes, it's a matter of turning it on its head or just employing some irony and personality and all that jazz.
How do you make, in your work today, how do you make fashion irony?
So I don't know if it's the fashion itself that needs to be ironic, but the thought behind it for me, there needs to be a decent amount of irony. And that comes from fine art training for me.
Okay.
It's not particularly from fashion, but in order for me to be excited about it before I even put pen to paper or put fabric to the dress form, the story behind it needs to be somewhat ironic. It's okay, if I'm really into blue, then it can be blue, but then it's the blue that is it's the deepest blue that you find in the vein. Oh. You know, so there's something
like
about
your shirt,
it
deep blue.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of midnight.
Okay.
Deep navy.
Again, I wasn't great at coloring.
But you just need a point counterpoint kind of thing.
Okay.
So that's what I think irony does for
you.
For the artist, for the creator.
Got it.
If you see that, it's okay if you do or don't. I just think it creates a product that'll be more exciting for you, the viewer, the buyer, the customer.
So I want to get into that creative process where we do, you have a whole lot of very exciting things that are going to inform that, right? That conversation, which is you have designed for a number of high profile individuals who are all household names that go by one name.
They do actually.
There's Beyonce, there's Michelle. We got them all, right?
Yeah.
And you have an incredible new collection that you're working on with Banana Republic,
yes.
Which is the sort of the epitome of everyone can buy it versus a runway. And
but
you were very runway heavy
before
that, which is 100%. Designing dresses or outfits specifically for someone to walk on a red carpet, right?
Well, no, not so much. I mean, the runway collection was kind of relegated to the runway because that was the space in which buyers would see the product for the first time, and it was a designer's opportunity to kind of tell a story in this showroom presentation.
Okay.
So it was a runway or a showroom presentation for that reason, after which the buyers would buy, clients could make personal requests, that kind of thing.
Got it.
But this iteration of the collection before Banana Republic was meant to speak more directly to a customer base and less to an industry, which is what the fashion show format typically does. And then with the banana thing coming along, it really did kind of affirm that agenda for me. and also allowed me to do it even on a grander scale. And I worked at Banana Republic as a sales associate.
This is a good story. Banana's gonna milk this for everything in the marketing. From sales associate to fashion designer.
Exactly. I may have put that on my LinkedIn announcement.
Okay.
From sales associate to collaborator.
Okay.
But it's true. I was like, I think 2002.
I was at Express. An Express Men's. But yes.
Wow.
I mean, listen.
Maybe that explains the, you know. okay. Express.
So you've got these three stakeholders, right? Yeah. So you've got the industry, you've got consumers, and then you've got yourself and your creativity.
Yes.
So starting with that last one, I love art. Don't get me wrong. I love everything about it. I love, and all forms of art, right? Like I love the ballet. I love architecture. I love design and drawing. And when I think about drawing and sketching and fashion, what I think about most is like there's a blank page in front of you and you have something in your head and you have to get it out on the blank page.
Yes.
So like when I hear myself singing in my head, I sound like Michael Bublé. Do not sound like Michael Bublé when it comes out. Bublé. I don't know. Yes. Joe's a very classy individual.
I love it.
It does not sound like Michael Bublé when I sing. And when I see the drawing in my head, I can see the perfect drawing, right? Like I've got it. And then if I try to put it on paper, to say it doesn't go well is a generous statement. So like, how do you, aside from the technical skill, how do you get something out of your head and on paper or in fabric?
I think first off, it's not as premeditated as configuring an image in your mind and then holding your body to realizing it on the paper. I think when the version of a creative that I am, so I'm not making like too many overarching statements, the process of putting pen to paper actually brings about the vision. The things I've thought about preemptively are, you know, inspirations and story and all that jazz that I was mentioning before. But then there's a lot that just happens on the page or on the dress form. It can be finding a fabric that you love. And then once it's placed on the dress form, you see that it does.
The dress form is a mannequin.
Yes.
Right?
It's a bust of a particular kind of idealized size of the women or men's form. And in fashion, you typically work on a size 4 or size 6 when draping initially. And
that's an industry point of view, because that is not a consumer.
100%. And which is a very problem, like it's a decision that was made a long time ago, and it's become kind of the basis of a lot of grading up and down to sizes. That changes with different, you know, kind of every designer I think should have their own kind of idealized form, because then that brings different customers to them. And so I've definitely worked to, I pad my dress form, I revise it because there's a certain kind of fit that I prefer. But anyway, a lot of creativity and configuring of a garment happens on the form, or it happens on the page.
So you're like dressing the mannequin a little bit and seeing what you like, what it looks like, and that sort of thing.
Yes.
Not unlike what I did as a child with like blankets, but like more advanced.
That happens, and it happens with me. Like I'll definitely sometimes like toss like some fabric on me, and I'll be like, okay, this kind of works. And you go to the form, and then you see if it went like okay, and it just kind of takes shape. It's really you know. So yeah, no, I'm totally putting blankets on me and sheets. Forever. And like my mom's wig.
Okay, well, at least I'm not, I'm crazy, but now you're also crazy. So it's
I'll take it.
Okay, so that's getting it out of you. And to say nothing of like the spark of imagination, right? Of what that takes. And then you have the industry. Mm-hmm. So like you're preparing, you go from what's on the forum to like what the industry expects. But like, how do you meet those things in the middle? Because the industry has some very specific ideas. Like I like to read the New York Times reviews of fashion shows back when they had fashion shows and think, this is absurd. Mm-hmm. There's an entire industry, cottage industry of critique and form, and this collection is uninspiring. And I'm like, seems good to me though.
Yeah, and it can definitely sound absurd to people who aren't within the industry. That's why that's one of the things that's kind of complicated fashion. I think there are certain languages and certain ideas and kind of critiques that are best understood in industry because fashion, because then people perceive like, oh, you kind of thinking too highly of yourselves. Whereas it is an industry that determines how we garb ourselves every day.
I mean, that's the famous phrase. Hit the famous phrase from Devil Wears Prada, right? True. To you, it's just blue, but this filtered down to the bargain bin. So how does something so insular become so mass consumer? Like, how do you make that leap from the cerulean on the cover of Vogue to the bargain bin sweater?
Well, I mean, it's not a leap because there's all of these, there's so many steps in between it. So you know, you're kind of early adopters of a particular class and
but how do you as a creative make that leap?
Like, I don't have to. I have to speak to my customer.
Okay.
And wherever I am, you know, in the kind of cycle of fashion, that's what I'm brokering. I'm not tasked with doing that unless my business does that. Unless one has a business that is kind of hitting almost every tier of fashion, then you are having to figure out how to take this idea and make it relate to kind of different types of customers. And in some ways, I am juggling that with this new Banana collaboration because I am taking ideas that are what I find quite forward and modern, particularly like a sense of color that I like to bring to the table. And then how do I reflect something that satisfies my creative agenda in the world, but at the same time doesn't overly alienate individuals who may be just less acquainted with that creative agenda and may have a different taste. Yeah. Well,
and that's something that I struggle with, right? So this is the crux of the matter, as they say, which is so how do you start this process? Do you design something that you love, finish it, and then be like, these are the following things I need to change for other people to like start to love it?
No, I definitely...
Okay, I got that wrong.
I think it's... I mean, it's just far more organic than that. All right.
Don't do that.
No, I think it's kind of a part of the process. You know, like I'm living in the world just like my customers are, right?
Yeah, but so, do you ever put something on paper or on the form that you're like, oh, I love this, but no one else is going to like this? Like, I do that with marketing campaigns, right? Yeah. Like, I come up with a great marketing campaign, and then I realize that it's going to be a Kendall Jenner Pepsi moment, and then I have to quash it. So,
well, yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying, but said marketing campaign, is that for you? Or is that for
another, a client? Yeah.
Exactly.
But this is for you. Okay.
Yeah. And so there's something you're in this position as a designer often because people do see value in your point of view. So you're not in a space where you're going to overly compromise it because it's what brought you to the table. You know, it's what made them look in the beginning. So you're always trying to be respectful of yourself as an artist and groom yourself as an artist. But then in the midst of it, you're also thinking like, I got to pay these bills.
I gotta keep these the bills on. Are very important.
Exactly. And you're thinking, okay, well, this client like always likes this, or like that store, like, you know, they typically love this kind of pant. And so you're just kind of inherently like fusing it in. And then, you know, after that, you get to the merchandising stage where you're either working with yourself or a merchandiser or a merchandising team, and then they are giving you that concrete information.
They're like, we're gonna need a deep V-neck on this.
We need a deep V, we need two more pants. One needs to be wide leg, one needs to be cropped. We need a tailored blazer with a strong shoulder.
Do you begin to feel like a machine? You're like, okay, here's my output now?
Yeah, at that point, but you have to have already kind of satisfied your artistic agenda, so then you're kind of leaning into your entrepreneurial one.
Does it like grind you to have your name on something that like has to be a deep V white pant? Like, that's not...
Well, if I don't like it, I'm not doing it.
Okay.
Like, I have to find a space where I like the idea of it. So it's like, okay, there's a deep... Now, when I'm working for a client...
It's not a deep V pant, I guess, but you know.
Exactly. I get what you're saying. I mean, if I can find where I appreciate that and I wouldn't mind Harbison's label being on it, then I'll do it. Then, however, when I'm design directing for like a third party... If they say they want a deep V, and I'm like, okay, here's your deep V. But oftentimes, if I don't think it should be there, then the market affirms my point of view.
Oh, yeah. So here we go. So Charlie's always right in the end.
I mean, not always right, but I mean, I have been doing this a minute.
Yes.
And I love it. And so I try to apply a lot of thought to it.
So when you're applying that thought to the collaboration with Banana, mm-hmm. right? Which is everyday America, mm-hmm. right? Let's say middle class, upper middle class a little bit, right? Like, we're not at the Old Navy price point.
Exactly.
where do you even begin? Like, do you start with your own inspiration?
I do.
Go out in the world and see what they're buying now and be like, okay.
No, I start with my own inspiration. Like, I go back to this kind of collection of images and ideas and stuff.
So you start with the world around you that you're inspired by.
Yeah, I start by my world. And then it's actually, this banana thing is easier for me because I think about all of the customers I was never able to engage at the price point that Harbison was at before.
Expensive.
Yes. Got it. Know, and only, you know, the logistics of making clothing.
Beyonce, yes. Sally in Tulsa, no.
I mean, if Sally had the coin. Yeah. But oftentimes, particularly like the women that, you know, from where I'm from, you know, I was never able to get product.
Are you designing a First Sunday collection? Is that what it's called?
No.
You'd be so awesome.
You know what I do? I'm drawing on church culture. I do that all the time. But I am just thinking about, like, yeah, the people from where I'm from, North Carolina in general, and there's a particular excitement.
So when you design this for people who wouldn't normally be able to access Harbison, and they're like, okay, awesome. There's tail on tail of, like, you know, I think it was the Missoni's, the Target, mm-hmm. and then like all these mm-hmm. like high-end designers that like everyone crazy went for it, right? Because totally. they had accessibility, and it was also something that they could relate to, but it was a little bit edgy. How do you introduce something new to a consumer, right? Like, when there's a new fashion trend or you want to push the boundary in some way, how do you introduce that? Can you introduce that? Do you just let somebody else do it and then come in with a better version?
I mean, being independent, you have the freedom of doing whatever the hell you
want. But for like a mainstream consumer, like, but I
even
think.
Even then.
Okay.
Yeah, even then, it's like, you know, Banana doesn't collaborate with you because they want the same beige turtlenecks that they've been doing, you know?
Yeah, I do love a good banana sweater, though.
No, I do too. Okay. But yeah, they're opting into a new conversation, a new customer. You know, like, this wasn't like a thoughtless choice.
Okay.
Not only, you know, are my designs more kind of modern and geometric, I with gender, which is important to me. But then on top of that, my references are overwhelmingly Black, you know, just because that's my experience in the world as a Black person. So the muses and the early references are Black. And so Banana is not known as being a part of that kind of conversation. So that's quite freeing for me because I don't find myself working with them, having to work outside of who I am and what I do. Yes, we can make this more kind of palatable for that customer, but we have to start with something concentrated, something like meaty, something specific.
So a very sharp scotch, and then you put the ice cube in it, and distills it down.
That's good.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So when you talk about messing with gender, mm-hmm. that's a difficult concept right now, right? Because a lot of people don't understand that, mm-hmm. right? Like, and I see all these trends out in the world, and some of them I find disturbing, right? Like the TikTokers who are gay baiting are like, oh, look, I'm messing with gender. I was like, no, you're just gay baiting for followers, exactly. right? Like, that's not actually art, and it's not authentic, and it's offensive.
Totally.
So take note, TikTokers. But for people who you are authentically exploring different things, it's more than just James Charles, you know, mm-hmm. as a spokesperson, right? It's, you know, I go back to pink was a man's color in the 19th century, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. then somehow it became a woman's color, but mm-hmm. I look great in pink and, mm-hmm. and it's a strong men's color. Mm-hmm. When you are messing with gender or you're playing around with concrete pieces that can have an impact, what does that look like for you?
I mean, I'm definitely not looking at TikTokers or James Charles. Okay. You know, like, there's nothing currently happening around gender that is so like new and just so invigorating for me that it's like blowing my mind. I look at
it seems like a bunch of teenagers acting out in those cases.
Cases specifically. Mm-hmm. And you know, the honest, I gender, my parents with gender in their presentation. I grew up with a mother who wore pantsuits like none other. You know, she was she would rock tailoring with a bust, small waist, beautiful hips and butt. You know, so she was opting into a clothing dialogue that is overwhelmingly relegated to men, but in her body and doing it beautifully. And then my dad would, you know, he played sports growing up. I remember him in crop tops when
he's like a football practicing. Coach.
Football coach, was a football player. I remember him putting a brooch, one of my mom's brooches, like on my collar here for like school pictures. I remember him wearing.
It's a bold move for a man from Appalachian, North Carolina.
Well, yeah, but it wasn't even seen as a bold move. It was just like it was adorning. And there's like, I mean, in the Black community, like an adornment and a thoughtfulness around dressing is just kind of par for the course. It's okay. What, you know, that's a part of living out your Black Americanness in many circles. Dad would take mom's earrings and use them as like pins on his tie. I remember like,
was your mom pissed off about that?
No, not at all. It was just like,
she's like, give me my, I want to wear those.
I mean, things would get lost, but it was an excuse for her to buy something else. So, you know, it all kind of worked out, but yeah, it's just so. And then for me, I would wear like girls' clothing, women clothing that was like marketed to girls and women. But you are
a tall man. That led to some interesting proportion play.
Well, maybe. I just felt like, oh, I wanted this drapey sweater.
Okay.
And I could only find it. Or, I liked how my mom would dress. And so I remember, you know, taking like a blouse of hers and wearing it on myself. And it wasn't me opting into like a different gender. I was still very cisgendered in my presentation. I'm not saying that one needs to be, but I was. But even in a cisgender presentation, there's so much more that one can opt into sartorially. And I think people inherently do that without acknowledging that they do it. And then if someone tells them, oh, that's what you're doing as well, there's a way in which all of us are more and more affirming of and understanding of those who kind of more obviously work outside of a cisgendered approach to life and dressing. But come on, like I'm definitely not looking at any of these kids now for, you know, thoughts on that.
No, TikTok is, I can't.
My choir director wore makeup, you know, when I was young. You know, it's just like.
They're the OG, I guess, right? The originators.
Exactly. And so for me, it's just like, oh yeah, like if I want a bold eyebrow when I go out at night, I'm going to put it on. And, you know, if I want a silk blouse and I can't find one on the men's rack, I'm going to go to her rack to see if I can find what I want.
Well, for everyone who thinks that they're doing something new and groundbreaking, I love that you literally just schooled them that your choir director in North Carolina was doing it 30 years before them.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They need to know their history.
And that's, as queer people, that's very important for us to talk about, you know, to kind of remember, you know, the images that, at least for me, that I saw growing up so that we don't kind of over maybe aggrandize or overly elevate what's happening now. Like you are a part of a compendium of like a movement forward. And so it's a beautiful thing.
So how are you bringing that to play now?
That means that like the coat that it will be on sale with Banana Republic will not only be on her, but it'll also be on him.
Awesome. So it's both a men's and women's.
It's a women's collection.
Okay.
But you know, I'm definitely, regardless of you know what I can continue fighting for with Banana, on my social and on my images, there will be that because I will be trying on the pieces. I will be making sure that they work on my body, on my cisgendered male body, and so there are several pieces in there that I want to be able to be worn by all body types, and not just in terms of gender, but also in terms of sizing.
Well, that's the other question, right? So you have these beautiful creative ideas in fashion, and we have these idealistic notions that are outdated, right? Like we're all assaulted by the six packs on Instagram and it annoys the hell out of me. I have lots of other things to say that are expletive and then have to be bleeped out for me saying them about the sheer onslaught of that imagery. But we also live in a country where a third of people are obese, 2/3 of people are overweight. How do you, A, design for that population, but B, how do you use fashion to help somebody embrace the positivity of how they look when it doesn't match the calendar expectation?
Of course. Well, designing for different body types is easier for me because that was the image of beauty that I saw first. I come from curvy women, both whether they're thin or when they're overweight, they all are curvy. And so I found beauty in that in the beginning, the faces and the bodies that nurtured me, that loved me, that I found beautiful. So that's easy for me. And the catalog of women that I dressed is diverse in that sense as well. Then when it comes to, I guess, affirming different types of beauty. The clothing that I make has always been the goal for it has always been to give my customer the tools to represent themselves in the world with more power and elegance and confidence. Right. So if this coat does that for you, then I want you to have it. And I want you to live that out. If this blouse does it, if this dress does it, that's my goal.
You're not the designer saying, please don't wear my clothing, as some notorious designers have been in the past.
No, not at all. You know, even people who, like, I don't agree with, like, you know, on certain things, like, still, like, if you like this.
So you can wear the coat with the MAGA hat?
You can. You can wear the coat with the MAGA hat. And then I want everyone to you know, say to you how dumb of a decision that is, because this black boy from the South designed that coat that you love so much with your MAGA hat on, you know? So if the clothing pieces can be used to kind of initiate those kinds of conversations, then let's do it.
Needling.
I know you are. I got you.
Well, I mean, I think that's the incredible part about it, is that there's the story that the TikTokers aren't aware of, their heritage, right? Mm-hmm. There's the story of everything that you wear that is your heritage, right? Like, yeah. And it's all part of something. And I think if there's something I've always known, but has been brought into greater relief by doing these episodes, is that there's an intentionality mm-hmm. to the world that we bypass a lot. And like, I'm just interviewing a lot of people who are very intentional mm-hmm. about the things they do. You know, a mom, a dad, a designer, an architect, a doctor. Like, it's incredible to me not just how intentional they are, but how much their intentionality benefits me, even when I don't ask for it, right? And how much it benefits all of us. And I kind of, like, I find myself struggling to, like, make sure that I am properly intentional, like, really properly intentional to reflect that. And it's interesting because you are so, you pull this out of your head and it's on the page or on the form, and it's a choice, like, it's an inspiration. And then anyone who picks it up in Banana, do they know that? Do they think about it? Or do they just put it on and say, I look awesome, right?
Yeah, and you want all of those people. You want the people who are selecting it thoughtfully and the people who are selecting it more kind of like, you know, just a gut reaction to something. You want it all, because you want to kind of titillate people on many different levels. That's what good design does.
Okay.
It draws you to it, even if it's visceral, I think. That's what happens with me in good design. That's what the Bauhaus says about good design, form and function, that it is supposed to make lives easier or better, because there is intention behind it. You're not just tossing out an aesthetic for the sake of an aesthetic. There is a function. There's a question it's seeking to answer, whether the customer knows it or not.
I love that. I am seeking to answer all kinds of questions. You have answered several for me and probably for a lot of other people too. So thank you for joining today. I really appreciate it. And thank you for tuning into The World According to Craig, which as usual contains an interview with somebody who I find deeply fascinating, incredibly smart, and I basically tried to crib things that I will use for my own future purposes. So thank you for tuning in this week's episode. And for more things to crib, tune into future episodes. And thank you for joining us today, Charlie.
Thank you, Craig. It was lovely.
Thanks. Thanks for tuning in to The World According to Craig. But it's not really the world according to me. It's according to some incredible people that I know with real everyday stories that we can all take inspiration from. I hope you'll tune in every week for a new episode of The World According to Craig.